Welcome to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. Here are your hosts, Daniel Meyer and Chris Tatro.
All right, happy Wednesday. Welcome back to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. Today we have a different guest, a special guest for us that we're pretty excited to have here today, Minnesota native Melissa Bachman. I'm going to read her bio here for you, and then we'll get introduced to you to her, and then we'll get on the way here. So Melissa Bachman grew up in a time when outdoor television offered a new career path where none had existed before, and in a place in central Minnesota where outdoor dreams can come true. She was raised on hunting and fishing, surrounded and guided by family and mentors to whom the outdoors wasn't just something you did. It was a way of life. Bachman pursued her academic life with the very same tenacity she approached her passion for hunting. After graduating with honors and armed with a degree in television broadcasting, and another in Spanish from St. Cloud State University, Melissa set her sights on a career in outdoor television. She began as an unpaid TV intern, driving 150 miles a day to work for free. Within months, Melissa Bachman was offered a position as a full-time producer, where she traveled the country filming, producing, and editing shows with a variety of incredible hunters on some fantastic adventures. Although close to her dream job, Bachman truly longed to be one outwitting her prey and squeezing the trigger. So she spent every spare moment of her free time arduously filming and editing her own hunts. Finally, with time, patience, and persistence, Melissa got some solid shows into the right hands, and her wish became reality. Mentors share. It's what they do, and sharing the great outdoors and the adventure is what Melissa wanted to do. Her choice was to do this through television. Today, Melissa spends over 200 days a year in the field, around the globe, filming and producing her series Winchester Deadly Passion in its 12th season, but it hasn't stopped there. Her journey and her commitment to the outdoors, family, the conservation of nature, and sharing have made Melissa an ambassador for the way of life we all cherish. Melissa now calls South Dakota home with her husband, Ben Bearshield, and their four children. Thanks for being on tonight, Melissa.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate you taking the time to join us.
We know you got a busy life and you got a full family over there, so it's pretty awesome to get you there. Looking back, I've actually met Melissa on a few different occasions. I met Melissa at the Minnesota Game Fair. At one opportunity, and also with the Minnesota Ice Fishing Show. And then most recently at the Silencer Central Grand Opening with their new facility in St. Croix. I'm sorry, it's not St. Croix Falls, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So that was a pretty interesting grand opening that was really fun to be at and bump into Melissa again. And that's when we were able to speak with her and see if we could get her on the podcast and talk about herself and her life. So going through your bio here. So you're a Minnesota native. Whereabouts in Minnesota?
So I grew up in Painesville. It's just a tiny little town with about 2,500 people between St. Cloud and Wilmer. So west central Minnesota, small town life, absolutely loved it. The best part is we were raised on a little over 100 acres and we could go out pheasant hunting. We could go deer hunting literally right behind our house. And we only lived about half a mile from the lake. So we actually had a deal in our house. If we got our chores done in the summer, my mom would leave a long list of chores. We could hop on our bikes and run down to the lake and fish for the rest of the day. So I'm really, really happy and just proud of the upbringing I was given in such a wonderful little small town.
That's awesome. And then, you know, with the outdoors, is that something that you kind of always had a passion for, or did your parents kind of push you into, you know, wanting to go get into, you know, the hunting and the fishing?
Well, my mom and dad both hunted, so they brought us all the time. It wasn't like an option on Saturday mornings. Everyone was going hunting because my dad jokes he didn't want to pay for a babysitter, which is probably true. But they brought us along and they involved us in it together. And I think that's so important because nowadays a lot of families, they don't have things that they can do together. And it's not only just the hunting part. It's the scouting. It's processing the game and then learning how to cook all of that. That was just part of how we were raised. And I think it's so important and it really helped mold me as a person. And it really got that love of the outdoors in me. I couldn't even sleep before my 12th birthday. I was so excited because I could finally go deer hunting. So that passion was just there. And I just couldn't wait to try to find some way to make a living out of hunting.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's one thing that you don't see too often anymore is, you know, families involving everyone with, you know, the hunting, fishing, and then the scouting and processing of the game and then cooking it. It's kind of like, hey, you know, I mean, I'll be gone for the weekend. I'll come back and have some wild game for us.
Yeah, I think it was important. And I think it's important for young kids to also understand how their food gets to their plate. Years back, I had a big controversy. People, the anti-hunting community has come after me numerous occasions. And I had, I believe it was a third grade class write to me saying what an awful person I was because I'm a hunter. And I really wanted to write back and remind these kids, like chicken nuggets, they're not just out of a package, right? They come from something. Right. And I'm reminding people that comes from somewhere. And what better word of mouth than among kids, right? Like if your kids tell other kids that it was fun and all of a sudden, like in our community, we're bringing kids out left and right hunting and then we're getting their animals processed and sending the meat home, whether their parents know how to hunt or not. Everybody knows how to make burger. Everyone knows how to eat jerky sticks, you know? So you're just kind of reminding people that, I mean, I get cat lovers all the time who will write online saying they're vegans and they're so upset with me being a hunter. Well, wait a minute, cat food, probably not plant-based material. You know, there's just a lot of different areas that people need to remember comes from meat and from animals.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very interesting when you talk to individuals who are not very familiar with the outdoor world and hunting and whatnot, the amount of conservation that is a portion of it too, the amount of, you know, if we don't put these herds in check or be able to help manage them, that there's going to be some issues down the road. And a lot of individuals do not see that. And it's when you have that first conversation, and sometimes it can go really well or very poorly, but you discuss the disease and the different things that could occur in these different animal populations. Individuals, I think when they hear that for the first time or two, that it kind of is eye-opening for individuals to realize that the world that they have in their purview is not as small as they actually think. It's much more broad.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the fact, like, I've had conversations with people who wonder, well, it doesn't make sense to me about hunting animals in Africa, for example. And when you explain that, if an animal doesn't have value, they want it gone, right? Because all it's doing is simply taking grass from the cattle that they use to feed their families. So things need to have value, or the people who live there will just make them disappear. And I think people don't really comprehend that. And when you tell them, most people can understand a conversation and say, yeah, I never thought of it that way. And it makes sense. So I think you got to look at each person and see if they're willing to have a conversation and try to educate people. That's one of the things I try to do as much as possible.
Yeah. I was actually going to bring up the Africa hunt that you did. You know, there's a lot of controversy with that one. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize, one, the amount of work that goes into it. You're not just going over there sitting in a lawn chair, killing a lion or an elephant, whatever game you're going after. And then, you know, from my understanding, majority of that goes back into whatever community tribe that you're hunting around. So it's not just wasting the meat to get the trophy mount at all.
Not even close. I mean, they utilize more things than we would ever imagine. Every single skull was even used to boil the head out for soup. I mean, nothing goes to waste there. And you've got to remember that the hunting is a huge industry over there. Without it, a lot of these places, they literally don't have jobs. There is nothing to go do and make a living for your family. So a lot of them will either turn to poaching to try and feed their family, or they're looking for good jobs. And when they can have a good hunting job, that's a big deal to these guys. And it brings in a lot of people, a lot of money, and then they get to take the meat home to their family. So not only are they out working, they're bringing back protein to families, to schools. It's very, very important and all part of their whole system over there.
That's one thing that speaks to a little bit with the poverty situation too. That's not just overseas either. That's here, you know, in our backyard. Individuals that do have a difficult time making a living. And in my career, I've also seen where individuals have taken animals illegally, you know, and you go to have a chat with them, and you find out that they are down on the times and money's tight. They got a family, you know, and the conversations I've had with some of these individuals is the fact that, you know, hey, there's a way to do this. you know, the way that you did it's not the right way. However, come to me and talk to me, because if you're having some problems, you need some deer meat in your freezer, I'll get you on a list, because we get roadkills or illegal animals that get taken, and we can gift those out. So, I mean, it's just not anywhere other than the U.S. It's still in our backyard, too, and we see it on a pretty normal basis.
And I think what's important with that is spreading the word among hunters. I mean, I'll be honest, with all the regulations trying to get meat across state lines now, a lot of times we keep our meat from South Dakota. And if I shoot an animal in Montana or wherever it may be, a lot of times I'll take it to the processor, I'll pay for the processing, and I donate the meat to a local family in need. So I'm not just giving them a deer carcass. I'm literally letting them, you know, whatever you'd like, we'll get it made for your family. And that way they get it nice, packaged up. And honestly, there's no better game than, you know, nice lean venison or elk or whatever it may be. So I think if people can understand that and realize that it's very healthy for their families, and it's an easy process, it's not that hard. You can ask around, and usually someone knows of a family that would be very thankful and appreciative to it.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, the meat that you get from wild game is going to be way, way better than whatever processed stuff you buy from the grocery store. And majority of the country, they believe, even the people that are, you know, anti hunters and everything, they believe that if you go and buy a 1 pound package of beef or whatever from Costco, that, you know, that's somehow more moral than going out and, you know, shooting a deer that you had fair chase with.
Yeah, you see it all the time. It's, again, it's the disconnect there. It comes all the way from kids all the way up. And mm-hmm. You know, still think chocolate milk comes from brown cows and it comes back from cellophane. I mean, it's hard to believe, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, Dan, I don't think Costco sells 1 pounds of beef ever.
I mean, they sell in like 1 pound, 1 pound packages, but you got to buy like 15 pounds of it at a time.
Yeah, right. Well, very cool. So I just want to kind of come back to, you know, your younger life and with the children. Do you have siblings? Did you mention
if
you
had siblings? Yeah, I have one younger brother.
Then did you do a lot of outdoor stuff with your younger brother when you were growing up?
Yes.
So are you guys still pretty close connected with the outdoor world?
Yeah. He actually moved to Vietnam and was living there for about 4 years. And he just moved back about a month ago. So I had a new bow sitting there waiting in his house when he came in. So he's all pumped because he hasn't been able to hunt for a long time over in Vietnam. Him and his family kind of got stuck over there for a while. But he is very happy to be back, and we'll be doing a lot of hunting together.
That's cool. What over in Vietnam, I mean, what did he said? No, not much for hunting over there for him or anything like that?
No, not at all. He was actually a computer programmer and could live anywhere. And he was traveling the world with his company. And each month they'd travel to a new country. And he stopped in Vietnam, loved it there, met his wife, had kids, the whole thing, got stuck there with COVID, couldn't get back to the U.S., but there's no hunting. And he said the one fishing that they tried to go do, they weren't catching anything, and they looked upstream, and a guy was netting the entire river stream in front of them. Wow. And that's totally illegal.
Yeah.
Different world.
Yeah, and that just, yeah, it shows, you know, resources get, sometimes abused in other places too, where people don't have the opportunity to actually get out and actually engage or be in the outdoors and hunt their prey. So that's a very different aspect too. But within your youth too, though, you're talking about that you became an intern. And what did that whole situation look like? I bet it sounds like it was a lot of work.
It was. So I got done with college. I had a double major, and I thought I was going to go out and have every job offer on the table. And I applied, I think, at 74 different locations, and I got 74 no's. Not one person wanted to hire me. And I wasn't, like, applying to be on camera. I was applying to be a cameraman, and nobody would hire me. So what I ended up doing is figuring out the place I wanted to work the most, called, asked them if I could come in and work for free. And they said, sure, when can you start? And I said, tomorrow. And they said, well, what can you do? And I said, well, I can do whatever you need. I can sweep floors. I can edit. I can film. And they said, okay, we'll see you. They, you know, and I drove back and forth 150 miles a day, every day for 4 months to make that internship happen. But after those 4 months, they actually hired me for the original job I applied for. So it worked out really cool, but it was very difficult in that time.
Took quite a bit of effort to prove your worth with them.
Yeah, and that's really all I wanted, you know. I just wanted a chance. It would have been nice to have a little gas money because I had to work another job at night to pay for my gas to go to my free job. So that wasn't ideal, but it really taught me, you know, if you want it, it's possible. Don't take no for an answer.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's a lot of work. That's 150 miles one way. Is that what?
150 miles a day, so 75 each way.
Okay.
And then I had to, as soon as I got back, I had to work another job every night to pay for the gas and my living expenses. So
that's crazy. And that was that when you were still in Painesville then?
I was actually in St. Cloud where I graduated.
Okay. College,
and I was literally living in a house. I think there were 16 or 17 people in the house, one bathroom. And I lived in like a little closet in the basement.
Oh, wow.
Man.
Just for cheap rent. So you do what you got to do.
Yeah. College life. So then after that, you got the job offer, and then you began, you said you started filming a lot of your own hunts as well, right?
So how I did it is my job was to film everybody else, and I would go on these trips all over. And because I was young, single, I was all about taking all the trips that were possible. So if I worked 30 days straight, they gave me 5 days off, and that was kind of my comp time. And I would go film my own hunt, edit it, and just wait till one of the other guys didn't get their shows done, and then offer it to them for free and say, here's a completely finished hunt if anybody is interested. And they started airing them. And then all of a sudden, a few sponsors said, well, what about that Melissa girl? And they said, no, she's just the cameraman. Don't worry about her. And enough people asked that I started being on the show more and more. And then I ended up, when they kind of got dissolved, the company there, I started my own company and created my own production company and started my very first season of Winchester Deadly Passion.
I don't think people really understand how much work's actually involved with filming a hunt. You know, we have our own production company that we use, Rogue Productions, and just the work that goes in with these guys we hire. They come along and they get to see what we do and help us get a product. They're very involved with us, but they're close friends. But the amount of work that goes in just hunting alone, being able to scout a specific area, know what you're doing, being proficient at it, then also trying to capture it on film is quite the task.
It is, and it's about dedication. You know, there's a lot of people who always joke, well, if I saw a big buck, I'd forget that cameraman, but I'm going to shoot that deer, right? Yeah, you can't do that if that's your job. Well, you can, but you're not going to have a job very long.
Yeah.
You got to be really smart about it. And, you know, you just have to be, you know, in the beginning, I was on the road nonstop. I traveled almost 320 days a year to make that happen.
Wow.
But you learn things. You become more efficient. You learn ways that are just not beneficial, both money and time-wise. And you become a little more efficient as you get older and do it longer. But I still, to this day, do every aspect of the show. I sell all the sponsorships. I edit the shows. I do have a guy who helps me edit the segments now. But I finish every show. I'm involved in every aspect of it. I book all my travel. I book every hunt, all those things, because I can do it and I don't want to pay somebody else for something I could do. So I guess in the beginning I had to, and now I choose to.
Yeah. And then with the, you know, once the filming's over, a lot of people don't realize the work that takes place afterwards, you know, editing the films, making sure that you've got all the right angles, all the audio lines up and everything else that goes into it. You know, that's majority of the time from what I've seen with Rogue, that takes longer than the planning and the execution part of it.
Yeah, it definitely can. And unfortunately, microphones die at inconvenient times, and there's only so much you can do, but you try to make the best possible.
Especially backcountry type hunts, you know, especially inclement weather, and that takes a toll on batteries and everything like that. And that's a bunch of extra equipment they bring with you in and out that you normally wouldn't.
And it takes a toll on gear. I've wrecked a lot of things.
I believe it. So I got to ask Dale. Dale's our lead guy with Rogue Productions. So what was the very first camera that you used? Do you remember that?
Are you asking him or are you asking me?
For you.
I used one of the big, there was a 700. I forget. Sony, it had a cache on it, so when we were fishing, we could hit it, and then it rolled back 6 seconds on a big HD cam tape.
Wow.
I forget what it was called, though. gosh, put me on the spot. I don't remember.
Sorry.
I remember those big HD cam tapes and huge batteries and a really big camera.
Yeah, technology's sure gone through the roof these years, and the quality with the longevity of the actual cameras have gone quite a ways now. It's pretty cool.
And then for the, so that very first hunt that you submitted, that you filmed and edited everything, do you remember what that hunt was?
So the very first one that was of me hunting, I actually went out and I shot a 202 inch whitetail monster. I had hunted it from 40 days off and on throughout the season, and I had a pack of coyotes chase it to me, and it was one of those deals where I couldn't even believe that we got it on camera. I edited it, and then they ended up airing it, and I look back at some of these shows now, and it's just brutal, right? Like, you do the best you can at the time, but nothing was great, but it was quite an accomplishment, and I was proud as can be of that show. Now it makes me cringe, but I always say every year you should look back at the year before and kind of cringe and know you're always improving. We don't want to go in the opposite way, so that's good.
Absolutely, and it had to start somewhere, and I mean, it got you noticed, you know, wanting all the sponsors and everyone wanting you to have a spot on the original show. So,
and then you ended up starting the show, Winchester's Deadliest Passion, all on your own.
Yes, I did. So I broke away, and the hard part I ran into is when you're trying to get a television show, you need to have airtime before you can sell it to sponsors, right? So, okay, how do I get airtime if I don't have any money, right? Nobody's funding me. No one's backing it. At the time, I owned a condo, like a townhouse, that I'm sure I owed a whole bunch of money on. But either way, I had to sign off my house in order to get that airtime.
No kidding.
I put my house on the line in order to secure the spot, and then went out and sold the sponsorships. And I was not a very good salesman in the beginning. So you look at things quickly. But I didn't lose my house out of the deal, so that was a bonus. But if you need motivation to learn to be a good salesman, put your house on the line.
And, well, that's part of being some confidence as well in yourself. I know I can do this. Put the house up.
Yep. Nobody else is going to foot the bill for me, so that's the only thing I had to offer, and that's what I did.
Well, that's entrepreneurship at its finest, right there. You got to put stack the cards against you sometimes in order to make it move forward.
Yep.
Well, that's awesome. So what are some of the more unique hunts that you've been on or have hosted on your show?
Well, I've done, you know, I really look at, you know, cool hunts and cool animals, but also interesting people and things to do. For example, I brought my grandmother, who's 79 years old. She hadn't hunted since she was in her 20s. And she mule deer hunted in her 20s. She shot the biggest buck, and the guy said she could never hunt again. And I ran across this footage, and I called her, and I said, "Grandma, I had no idea you hunted." And she goes, "Yeah, they just took me mule deer hunting once, but never again." And I said, "Well, come with me." So I brought my grandma at 79 on a spot and stock mule deer hunt in Colorado. We hiked through everything, and she shot a beautiful deer. And it was one of the coolest episodes. And we got done, and she goes, "Now, Melissa, I'm not going to have to put this on my wall and have a head looking at me like yours, am I?" And I said, "No, Grandma, you don't have to do that." So I actually had my friend Jana Waller. She beaded the whole skull for her. And it was just beautiful. It was all like Swarovski crystals. And I gave it to her for Christmas, and she loved it so much. She took down like 3 of her kids' wedding pictures and put that mule deer on the wall. So,
oh, wow. That's amazing.
That's a great memory to have too, though, especially having it on film.
Yep. And, you know, and that's some of the fun things. And, you know, taking kids, we've been to Mozambique. We were within like 35 yards of a leopard. My feet were shaking so much. They were like bouncing off the floor. It was just so cool to see, you know, hunting in New Zealand for tar. We did that. I was actually, I think, 6 months pregnant at the time. And we would start at the bottom every day and hike all the way to the top. And
wow, motivation.
When I booked the hunt, that wasn't the plan. I did not plan on doing that. I see why most people probably rent a helicopter, but we did it. And it was a really neat experience. And just, you know, things like that, that are just, they're not necessarily planned, but just work out. And then once I had our son, I had him August 20th and September 1st, we had an elk season open. And I told my doctor, I said, "I need to be hunting September 1st. And she was like, yeah, I don't know about this. Well, we did. We hunted all of September. My mom and dad came and watched Jax as a newborn. And I remember looking at my watch one day, and we had hiked 16 miles with heavy packs on. And my cameraman goes, do you think your husband forgot you just had a baby? But we ended up both killing the biggest bulls in the herd, and we packed them both out the same day. And if you want to learn how to get strong, that's how you do it. Get right back at it. You put an elk quarter on your back, your midsection gets strong real fast.
Yeah, especially 10 days after having a baby.
Yep, yep. So you shot the two biggest elks of the herd.
That's but we didn't shoot them on September 1st. We started hunting. It took us most of the month to get them.
Okay.
So I had a bit longer time, but we started.
Did you shoot them pretty close in proximity and time together?
Well, it was kind of an accident because my husband had gone out. I was to the point of exhaustion where I wasn't fit to be a mother or a hunter at that point because we had been getting no sleep and hunting all the time and up every hour with a baby. So he actually went out in the morning. They killed his bull, and he called me in to help pack it out. So I dropped our new son off with his mom and bring my pack. And he said, grab your bow just in case. We're cutting his elk up after taking pictures. We hear another bull bugling. And he said, that's where the other big one is. Should we go try to kill him? And I said, yeah. And we went. And the next thing I know, we've got two bulls down within like 200 yards of each other. And then we had to pack them all the way out. So.
And this is not one trip. It's several trips. No.
Absolutely not one trip. There was only three of us.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. I mean, was it normal?
I couldn't walk straight up. I was like hunched over because my whole core wasn't strong enough anymore to carry an elk quarter. But we got them all out, and it worked out good.
That's awesome. Now, I know now that you brought up your husband, you know, we talked about Ben a little bit here too. Do you want to talk about Ben and maybe his history with hunting and mm-hmm. what brought you guys together?
Yeah, you know, my husband's been a hunter since he was a little kid. He grew up in South Dakota, and I was actually on a hunt, and he pulled up. He was a game warden on the Rosebud Reservation, still is, and he said, hey, you know, are you guys, how are you doing? It was freezing cold and let us warm up in his truck. I think it was like 15 below or something like that, completely windy day and freezing. So we got to sit and warm up. We got talking. We went turkey hunting for numerous years together. We started deer hunting, and it just all worked out. We got married, and we absolutely love it out here. And he's still a game warden. It's just wonderful to be in such a great state that has so much opportunity. We have elk, we have antelope, mule deer, whitetails, pheasants. There's just so many things all in one location. And it's still small town. We like it out here a lot.
South Dakota is a pretty awesome state. We actually just did a family road trip through South Dakota. We made it over to Mount Rushmore and did that whole thing with the whole family, and then went up through Deadwood area and ran up to Medora. And I think just the different whole atmosphere and the environment was very eye-opening for my kids. And I think this is the first time any of them have actually seen antelope, especially out in the wild. So that was a pretty cool experience. And I have never hunted an antelope myself, and that's something that's on my bucket list. So hopefully I can get out there someday and get a shot at taking one.
Yeah, they're fun to see. I brought my mom on an antelope hunt, and she's like, they look like they belong in Africa. And I said, yeah, I guess that is right. True.
Yeah, they do. And you know, that's what you earlier brought up, the memories that come along with the hunt or the experience. And with HHO, that's what we see a lot of the times is, you know, not necessarily how big of a deer that was shot or the beard on a turkey or how big of a fish. It's the memories that are made when they're in the outdoors. And I mean, it can be a day where it's a complete miss and no one gets anything, but it's still an amazing experience for everyone, whether it's their first time hunting or fishing, or if they've been, you know, 1,000 times.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think sometimes hunting television takes away from that a little bit. That's why a lot of times I'll try to talk about the memories. And, you know, when we go back for Christmas at our family, those are the hunting memories that we talk about the most. It had nothing to do with the size of the animals. I mean, we didn't shoot that big of bucks in Minnesota. I shot one buck from 12 to 18, you know. That wasn't a concern. We just loved it so much. And I think you really do build bonds together. Like this year we brought, our son is 3 and we took him turkey hunting, and he's been practicing for months for this. and to see him and my husband out sitting next to each other in Nebraska, and just the excitement when it finally worked. We hunted hard and it finally came together. I mean, you just can't replicate that with almost anything, in my opinion. That's something that really brings people together.
Yeah, it really does. And you know, with that too, so Minnesota is they're big on their deer camps every year. Did you guys ever do anything like that growing up? Or I mean, you had your property that you lived on, so didn't really need to go anywhere.
Yeah, we had my grandma come in always and stayed with us, and then we got to go out with my mom and dad because Minnesota didn't allow you to hunt till you were 12. So there were a lot of years where we literally just had to hang out in the house and wait for them to come tell us they got a deer, and they'd let us come help track it. But once we were old enough, we always did it right at our house. So we never really had a deer camp, but it was definitely something we always looked forward to and could not wait.
Yeah. So talking about your kids, I actually just saw some videos with you guys out in Sturgis.
Mm-hmm.
And you had your boy. It was the most adorable video ever. I actually showed my wife and then she wanted to watch it again. It was so cool. That was awesome. So how was that trip and how did your kids enjoy that?
Good. You know, what we tried to do, Jax is he just turned 4 and he's someone where he's into everything. Like he loves baseball. He loves football. And we want to give him all the opportunities possible. So like this summer, he did a football camp and there's a hilarious video of him getting all pumped up for football camp. Same with baseball. And he loves motorcycles. So last year was the first year we brought him to Sturgis. And he had sleeves and tattoos, and he just thought he was the coolest kid ever. And he gets so much attention out there that he just loves it. I bet he was in 5,000 pictures, if not more. And he's doing wheelies and showing off. And, you know, it's another fun thing to do together in the summer, to just get outside and do something versus everyone being on phones or on tablets or whatever it may be. It's just something fun to do and to have another experience outdoors.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That electric bike. Sorry, Dan, I got to interrupt you. That electric bike he was on, he was doing he was doing burnouts in that thing. I was rolling. That was awesome. It looked like a good time.
Yeah, he enjoyed it.
And you do a lot of like going out to the outdoor expos and stuff like that. Are you gonna keep him involved with doing those when they're close to home?
Yeah, you know, I try to bring them when I can. I do a Minnesota show every year, the Minnesota Outdoor News Deer and Turkey Classic, and I try to bring him, but I don't want to bring him the whole time because I don't ever want him to get bored at these shows, right? So my mom and dad usually watch them, and they bring him for like the last afternoon for like 3 hours so he can go experience it all. I just always want to make sure that everything remains fun and is not gets boring or tiresome. You know, he's 3, right? He doesn't want to sit in a booth and talk to people. That's not what he wants to do. He wants to run wild.
It's pretty easy for kids, young kids, to get bored at those shows. I mean, there's only so many times you can go pet the deer or go look at the mounts that they have and talk to the different vendors. So,
and I try to bring him to each one for a short period of time, just so he's a part of it. But yeah, I don't bring him. I do the shows normally from start to finish, and I'm there the whole time. And I don't want to do that to him at this point.
Yeah, and those shows wear you out. You know, being there from 8 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night or whatever time they end. At the end of the day, you just want to lay down and go to bed.
Yeah, they're definitely long days. I love it. Like I always tell people that hunting's a small part of what I do. A lot is editing. A lot is just meeting people and being in the field. And I love talking with people and hearing their stories. But they are long days. You're definitely tired when it's over. I'm ready to go to bed.
Yeah, a lot of travel too. And the travel beats you up.
This year was brutal. I ended up driving to more locations because I'd get somewhere and my flight, I'd miss my connection and I'm not going to get there in time. So I think 4 out of 5 times in 1 month, I ended up renting a car and just driving to where I was going. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, it's been a lot worse the last couple of years with, you know, the delayed flights and everything. Like there was a couple of times I was flying back to Pennsylvania from Minnesota, you know, whether that be a banquet that we were having or, you know, going to visit the kids, and I'd get to Chicago at 7 o'clock at night and they'd be like, all right, flight's delayed. Next flight's not till the next morning. I'm like, well, I got to be at work. So I'm just going to rent a car and drive these last 7 hours.
Hard part about Chicago, a lot of times they never even had car rentals available. I looked one night, I was stuck in Chicago and there wasn't a car rental available. And our one son kind of needed a new car. So I thought about going and buying like a used car somewhere and just driving it home. And then I realized I probably don't belong out in Chicago looking to buy a used car at night.
So. Right.
Yeah. Definitely not.
Hard pass. No, thank you. Well, even finding a used car is impossible at this point, it seems.
We still don't.
Everything is through the roof. Yeah. No, that's very cool. And I just wanted to ask you, so with your connection with your husband, with Ben, and being a game warden, so it sounds like, does he get, what was the question I just had in my head? I completely missed it. I apologize. I was going to ask about the law enforcement side of stuff. So the demand for the job when it comes to law enforcement too, those effects that you feel out there are obviously going to be different than other places in the country. It seems like you guys are in a pretty supportive state when it comes to everything like that. During this whole, law enforcement issues in the past year, 2-3 years, have you guys felt much of that effect out there with that, or has the support been pretty strong still?
I think the support has been incredibly strong, and Christy Noem has been going over and above to tell people in other places, if you are not having someone who has your back in your state, move to South Dakota, and constantly telling people. And I think what helps is the communities are behind that as well. The support for everything that's patriotic with law enforcement, you just see like it used to be what I'd say like 30 years ago, right? And of course, you're going to have little pockets where you run into problems. But as a rule, I think it's all about people having your back. And that's what people need to know. You know, they're going in and out of their job, working, doing everything possible. And at the end of the day, they need to know someone up higher has got their back and is going to keep them safe and get them home to their kids and families as well.
And Ben's the chief game warden for out there too. So he gets to set a lot of that climate for his own department, right?
Yeah, so they have several game wardens, and then he's kind of the head of the different rangers. They call them rangers there. But the good news is, it's on the tribal reservation. So it's the Rosebud Reservation. They patrol about 1 million acres. So it kind of waits as to how many different rangers there are at that time. But it's a ways from our house, so it's probably hour and a half is where most of their headquarters are. But there's tribal land all over the place. So he sometimes will be the kind of the liaison working with some of the federal agents and different things like that. And just, is always among the people. And you get to learn a lot and bring people deer and talk to people and help people is, I think, a really, really big part of it.
Does the reservation, is that in South Dakota as well as Wyoming? Does it go across the border?
No, it's just Rosebud Reservation. It's just South Dakota. So if you can kind of see South Dakota, in the middle of the state is where we're at, and then he's just a little bit further west on that southern border, but not all the way. It's just all in South Dakota, all 1 million acres.
Okay, yeah, I'm not familiar with that reservation. I've had some work on reservations back here in Minnesota, but not familiar with that one. So I know there's a lot of unique dynamics when it comes to the reservation side of things too. Does he end up having to work with non-tribal hunters occasionally out there?
Absolutely, because they bring a lot of non-members in as well. So you're always dealing with a mix of people that are from the area, not from the area. The other thing is they've got a wide variety of game. They've got elk out there. They've got deer. They've got mule deer. They've got prairie dog hunters in the summer. You've got pheasant hunters. You've got a lot of different things going on at all times. So and they also have some water areas too, where they have fishing and things like that too. Not as much.
So we work with a guy in Minnesota. I can't remember what reservation that is, Chris.
That's Darius Roseberry, the Red Lake Reservation.
Yeah, with the Red Lake Reservation. Is it like that where in order for people outside of the tribe on the reservation, if they want to come hunt or fish, they have to use a guide from the reservation?
Yes, for the Rosebud Reservation. Now, there's about 3 or 4 different reservations in South Dakota. Each one has different rules, but on the Rosebud Reservation, if you're a non-member, you must be with a tribal member as a guide.
Okay.
Seems to be more, that's pretty common, and I think that's probably a very good idea, honestly, for not only for the reservation's sake, but as well as the hunters too, to have someone there that's experienced with them. Have you got to do any unique hunts on any of the reservation lands?
So we hunt rosebud quite a bit. We've had the two elk hunts that I was telling you about. We actually put in a bid for those. And we couldn't do it again now until I think this year would have been when we could do it again. But it's just a bid system. So we didn't know we were going to be having a baby in August. So I probably went to put in a bid for it that year. But it all worked out wonderful. So we've done elk hunts. I've shot mule deer. I've shot whitetails. We have some great whitetail hunting, and it's like anywhere, you know, there's not giant bucks everywhere, but if you work at it hard, you can find some nice deer.
Do you do any hunts when it comes to like upland birds, except for, you know, outside of turkey?
I do a couple. Usually I'll do one pheasant hunt a year. And the reason I don't do more on television is it's not that high of a rated show, right? Like pheasant hunting is really fun to do, but it's not as much fun to watch. So like last year, for example, I actually took two guys from Minnesota that won a hunt through a Fleet Farm giveaway. And they were the chief of police and the previous chief of police in a small town in Minnesota. And so they came out and we had just a wonderful trip together. Just the nicest people you could ever find. And so we did a nice kind of fancy pheasant hunt. And we all felt a little out of place because it was a pretty fancy lodge. And they're like, did you expect this? Because we're just wearing our old clothes here. And I said, no, we're all good. No worries. But, you know, it's things like that. To me, what I like about pheasant hunts is they're just a social hunt. We all got to enjoy, have fun. You don't get up super early. In fact, I joked and I said, now, why have I been a big game hunter my whole life when these guys don't start till mid-morning, lunch, they take a nap, they go back out. This is wonderful.
Right? Man, you ain't kidding. No, that's awesome. I did have a couple more questions regarding, how we met was at Silencer Central. So I just wanted to ask, you know, what's your involvement with Silencer Central?
So I've actually been working with them for several years now. It's funny because my husband met Brandon Maddox, the owner, years and years ago, back when he had just a little table and he was just doing it all himself. And we were actually at the SCI show and Ben came and got me. He said, hey, these are the guys I met years ago. We started talking with them. We realized, you know, we're both from South Dakota. All the hunting I do, I love shooting suppressed. So I started working with them. And they have just done such an amazing job of coming up with a streamlined process. The hardest part about doing any suppressors is trying to get all the paperwork done, right? And they've just made it so simple that I actually bought it for my dad for a Christmas present so he could go through the process. So I always joke, if my dad can get through the process in 10 minutes, anybody on earth can do it. It's simple. It's no problem. And he is the simplest process ever. Plus, they make great suppressors. And like when I started, I didn't really realize that I could get a Banish 30, for example, that's 30 caliber, and it does everything under. So like our coyote guns, we've got a little adapter that we put in, and we can put that on some of the coyote guns and then put it back on my 300 Win Mag. And before I really worked with them, I always thought I had to buy a different suppressor for every single gun. And I think a lot of it is just educating people and teaching them why it's helpful, helping your hearing. There's just so many things that it's a benefit to. And sometimes I have to explain to people online because they'll say, well, what do you need that for? You're not in the military. What are you thinking? And I say, well, we do a lot of hunting with kids and the lower recoil, there's a lot of benefits to it. And again, it's about education. And I think the more people that know that, I always joke, once you shoot suppressed, you're never going to want to shoot unsuppressed if it's legal where you're hunting, because it's just so much more enjoyable to shoot.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people out there that they'll shoot suppressed and be like, I thought this was supposed to be like dead quiet.
It's not the
whenever you have it on. Not the case at all.
No, and it's not the movies. People forget it's not a complete silent deal.
Do you know their chief financial officer, Josh Robinson, then?
Yes, I have met Josh.
So I don't know. I haven't seen Josh Robinson in 20 years. So actually I've known Josh Robinson since seventh grade. And really? Graduated high school with him and we both went our separate ways. And when we went to the grand opening in Sioux Falls there, I was just standing there. It was kind of a small world because just the week before I drove by his family farm in Lionel Lakes, they had a sod farm and Josh and I hung out there quite a bit. And I was wondering to myself, I wonder whatever happened to Josh Robinson. And then that one day we're standing in Sioux Falls and there's Josh Robinson. And I was like, what in the world?
Small world.
Yeah, super cool little reunion. You know, we're able to chat a bit about, you know, what we've done in life and where we've been. But to see him be the CFO of Silencer Central is pretty cool. And he's a really good guy, and he's always been a very nice, personable individual.
Yeah, he's very nice. I actually met him at SHOT Show when we were all meeting up with Christy Noem. She took time out of her schedule to meet with all South Dakota business owners. And, you know, just they really have a great group of people there, super knowledgeable, and they have it figured out. And it's great to work with someone that's also from South Dakota, but that really is an expert in their industry, and they are.
I think SHOT Show is a thing that me and Chris talked about trying to get HHO into one of these years, because they've got the spot for nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if we can make that happen. It'd be an amazing experience to get out there and get connected with all the different business owners that are there.
It really is neat. My husband got to come the first time maybe 3-4 years ago, and the whole law enforcement side, he thought it was the coolest thing. You know, you've got all the hunting stuff, all the manufacturers, the law enforcement, the nonprofits. There's just so many cool things to see, and it's such a big place. Takes a while. Put some good walking shoes on.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a lot of fun.
It'd be a good experience too for your husband. Chris and I have been talking about the police week that they have in DC quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Go out there and seeing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys had the opportunity to go to that at all?
We have not. No, we have not.
Okay. Next year, we're hoping to get a booth there, so we can at least go spread the word about what HHO does and see if we can get some more members and get them outdoors and get them some hunts. You know, a lot of what we do is pretty therapeutic for these individuals, military and law enforcement. So it's been a very good experience, you know, for us, and be able to help network with people like you, be able to showcase, you know, the different things that are out there and available to individuals, and show that the opportunities can be made on your own. And if it's something you truly want to do as a living and have a passion for, that you can do it. So I think your story is very beneficial for those people.
Yeah. And it has nothing to do with being backed financially. I mean, I had zero, and you can still do it. A lot of times I think people get where they're, you know, a little deflated because they don't have some big money person backing them or rich parents backing them. You can totally do anything. If I always said, I may not even be the most skilled hunter out there. I may not be the best, but I will outwork every single person next to me. And that's kind of been my motto all the way through and what I always plan. And I figure if you work that hard, eventually you're just going to get good by accident, right?
Yeah. And then for you know, the beginners out there that, you know, have never been in the outdoors, you know, into big game hunting or anything else, you know, as you mentioned earlier, people see all these TV shows that say, you know, they've got all their big name sponsors like Sitka, all the other big brands that cost a ton of money. And getting into hunting doesn't cost that much. You know, when I first started hunting when I was a kid, going out in jeans and a Carhartt jacket and nothing more than that. But they see all these expensive clothing that they have to have, the expensive rifles or bows. Is, you know, for either kids or adults that are getting into the outdoors for the first time, what kind of advice do you have for them for just getting out there, you know, taking that first step?
A couple things is, one, I always try to tell them, find some sort of a mentor, someone that's in the hunting, that just a neighbor that likes to hunt, or a grandfather, or whatever it may be. So you kind of can figure out what do you really need and what can you get by without, just to get you started. And it's always nice to have someone to answer questions, because you're going to have a lot of questions. And people need to remember, there's no such thing as a dumb question. You can ask whatever you want. And you know, you can call local agencies. There's so many people that you can call to help you and give you advice. And then when it comes to buying gear, I always tell people, try to find used stuff. There's a lot of people out there with a lot of money who only wear stuff one or two times and then sell it at like 80% off. And that's bows, guns, clothing, you know, you name it. So it's always about, you know, try to do the best that you can with what you have, but used can go a long way, and finding a mentor that can help you, I think that's key.
Yeah. And then, you know, one thing you didn't mention is watching the shows like what you guys all make. You know, that's helpful. You know, take away the expensive sponsorships and everything else like that. There is a lot of good information in there, whether it be the televised shows or the videos that are on YouTube for just information purposes as well.
And I always tell people, you can write to me. People write to me on my website. I'll try to answer as many questions as I can, because I want people to know that I'm just like anybody else out there hunting. It might take me a little while. I might not see it. Sometimes the anti-hunters will inundate my entire inbox and there'll be like 5,000 messages so things can get lost in there. But know that there's a lot of people and a lot of knowledge out on the internet and on television that you can watch and see and learn from.
Yeah. I can't imagine the amount of anti-hunters that you get. We had a group out of the New England area. They started blowing our YouTube up from this this bear hunt that we did there. And it was like a week straight of just constant comments that we had to delete and get rid of because they were just plain nasty.
You'll notice almost all my YouTube, all comments are turned off.
Yeah.
That's smart. I probably should start doing that ourselves.
Wait.
Hey, I do have a question regarding upcoming fall hunts that you have this year. Do you have anything that's big in the hopper?
A lot of what we're doing this year will be whitetail based. So I have a velvet mule deer and antelope hunt to kick off the season in Colorado, and I'll do a couple mule deer hunts. But last year we did some really big hunts, Kodiak brown bear, Yukon moose. So this year I try to do every other year that's going to be really heavy on the whitetail side. That's what people love. People love seeing deer hunts. So I'm going to try to really hit that hard, go all over. I've got tags in Ohio, Kansas, South Dakota, Illinois, a bunch of different places. So it should be a really fun year. And that's always been my number one thing. It's what I grew up doing. It's my favorite thing out there.
Sounds like a pretty good lineup. I'm pretty jealous. My fall hunting is non-existent anymore, it feels like, with this line of work. It's just a little bit more difficult, but you got to find your own time. My highlight of my deer hunting is I do Wisconsin deer opener with my kids. So that's my go-to.
Yeah, you got work and then the whole squad of family.
I'm excited
for Chris to come out here. The Chris Ehrman, he's coming out. I'm taking him elk hunting here in Oregon.
Cool, great.
So that'll be a good time. Hopefully, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, awesome.
Those Roosevelts, right?
Yeah,
that'd be cool. Cool. Well, we thank you very much. You want to take a minute and talk about your show and how our listeners can tune in and watch your show?
Sure, you can catch it. It's Winchester Deadly Passion. We air every single Sunday morning year round on Sportsman's Channel. It's also 4 or 5 different times during the week, or you can just go to melissabachman.com. I try to keep everything updated on the website, or you can go to YouTube. The shows are about a year behind, just for network purposes, but you can see, I think, 11 seasons on YouTube. So type in Melissa Bachman and you can find it all right there and follow along on social. We're usually having a good time somewhere outside.
Yes, folks. And I will tell you that Melissa is incredibly approachable. She will sit and talk to you. I asked about doing the podcast with Melissa and I asked her her agent was, and she handed my card and she said, it's me, call me. And that was pretty awesome. So it's not your norm that we get with a lot of individuals. So I really appreciate that. And, we really appreciate you being a steward of the outdoors and showing your stories also and being close to it with your family, you know, to include your husband and his conservation efforts that he does with his job. So I think that's a pretty incredible piece to help showcase your life as a whole when it comes to being outdoors. So for our listeners out there too, you'll have to tune back in. We will hopefully circle back with Melissa later in the year here with another podcast regarding her hunts and hopefully have some other big information for individuals to tune into and be able to get excited about for some future stuff with HHO. So we'll let that teaser hang there though.
Always good to have a teaser.
Yeah. So we'll have you back at the end of the year, or if you allow it.
That would be wonderful. I sure enjoyed my time, and thank you guys for having me.
We appreciate you taking your time to jump on with us tonight.
You guys have a great fall, and tell your husband to be safe, and thank you for coming on.
Will do, and you guys the same.
All right. Until next time, we'll see you guys out on the water and in the woods.
Thank you for listening to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. For more information about Hometown Hero Outdoors, visit our webpage at www.hometownherooutdoors.org.